Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am really honored to share the microphone with the most interesting entrepreneurs. These are people who are authors, they're speakers, they are business people. They really have wonderful stories to share, and they're really excited to freely share their business wisdom, their tips, and their actionable advice. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And today I welcome Jim Tunney to the show. Known as the Dean of NFL Referees, Jim Tunney has been consistently called upon by the media for comments on plays, games, and incidents that occur each week in the sport. His on-field career is exemplary, having worked a record 29 postseason games, 25 Monday night games when Monday night football was the game of the week, 10 championship games, and 4 Super Bowls, 2 of which were back-to-back. To date, Jim is the only official in the referee position to have done so. He is also a published author of 10 books, and he currently writes on the Tunney Side of Sports, which is a weekly newspaper column for the Monterey Herald, a local publication in California, along with his regular weekly sports blog, Tunney Side of Sports. His most recent book is another 101 Best Tunney Side of Sports columns, and the foreword was written by Herm Edwards. Everybody knows who Herm Edwards is. In the show notes, there's also a very nice video. There's a link to a video on YouTube of Jim and Coach Don Shula discussing the book in the show notes. So anyway, Jim also holds a doctorate in education from the University of Southern California, and he is an internationally recognized professional expert in his field. He speaks internationally on topics of leadership, team building, and customer care. And he was inducted into the National Speakers Association Hall of Fame in 1980. Now, Jim tells me he's having a bit of trouble dialing in, so I am going to give this just a couple of more minutes and hope that he can get in pretty soon. Anyway, let me tell you, while I'm waiting on Jim, let me tell you a bit about the chapters in his book that I wanted to talk with him about today. His column is about insights and observations on personal values, and the chapters cover really everything that you need to know about personal values: attitude, character, competence, courage, family, integrity, judgment, mentoring, personal growth, success, teamwork, and values. Now, Jim is a friend of mine. He's been a friend of mine for quite a while, and we get to have the most interesting chats about everything. I mean, he knows so many people in the sport and out of the sport, and I think we just got him on the line. So let me quit chattering here and bring Jim in.
We are here.
Hi, Jim. Hi.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
I was just chattering away. Just, you know, I may just have to do this on my own. I'm so glad to see your number pop up.
Well,
I mean,
glad
I can do it. I know
out
you
here
well
in California,
enough.
Out here in California, it's all by Wells Fargo covered wagon, so we're a little slow getting started out here.
I'm sorry, and I suspect that part of that was my fault, but you're here, and I'm so happy to hear your voice. So anyway, I was chatting to my audience, sight unseen, about your book, and I'm sure you probably heard a little bit of that. But before we get going, tell people a little bit about yourself that I might have missed in the intro.
Oh, God, it's only an hour show. Do we have all that time?
I'll make time.
When I was 12 years of age, I don't know why, but it dawned on me that what I wanted to be in my life is a coach. And my dad was a coach, and maybe that was a pretty good influence, but I never thought of him as that's the guy I want to follow, although I did, because he was my first mentor and my first role model. And so from 12 years of age, all through junior high school and high school, I studied teachers and coaches. I didn't make it very scientific. It was my experiences watching them, thinking, this is a good teacher, or no, I don't think that teacher's the kind of person I want to be like, or I don't like this idea or that idea. And so all through that way, through college, the same way, and when I graduated as a physical education major from Occidental College, I became a coach. I became a teacher. That was my ambition. And I was student teaching in a high school in East Los Angeles called Abraham Lincoln High School. And the head of the department said, are you available next year? And I said, certainly, I'm graduating in June. He said, well, in September we start the new school year. We'd like you to come and coach our basketball team. And I did that. And it's been that kind of a life for me as a teacher and a coach. And then I moved into being we call it vice principal rather than assistant principal, I think, because I was in charge of the vice in the school. And the thousands
the
or 1,200 boys.
Right.
It was a boys' vice principal, I guess. I wasn't in charge of the girls. We had a girls' vice principal, and now I was a boys' vice principal. Now I was coaching all the kids, not just athletics, but everybody. And my whole life as ambition is not coaching in terms of how to shoot a basketball, how to tackle a runner, but how do you play the game properly? How do you play by the rules and play as a team? I always thought that was a wonderful thing for me, is playing on a team. And a number of years ago, jumping ahead a little bit, but I created a bookmark called TEAM, Together Everyone Accomplishes More, and I always thought that playing on a team I could accomplish a lot more than I could individually. So I moved on to being a high school principal, and then I was coaching teachers who coaching kids, and then I became a school superintendent. I was coaching principals to coach teachers to coach kids, and I moved from there and almost the same time became a professional speaker, speaking about teamwork and leadership and customer service. People don't realize that in the school business, you are in customer service. Those kids are your customers, and you're trying to take care of them and meet their needs, of course. And so it's always been that kind of thing, and I've delved into writing books. I've written 11 books now, mostly about the fact of how you can be a better person and help other people become better at what they do.
Well, how in the world did you wind up on the field then? I mean, it seems to me like you were crazy busy. How in the world did you wind up in jersey number 32 on the field? Not jersey, but how did you wind up as NFL number 32?
Jersey, good name. It's a jersey number 32.
Is it a jersey? Oh, I'm sure.
When I started teaching, and today teachers are similarly, they're getting better pay, but my pay was so minimal. In fact, my first paycheck was $300 a month for 10 months. I made $3,000 my first year of teaching. In order to supplement that, as I began a family, I was officiating high school football and basketball, nights and weekends and things like that. And in those days, they were paying for a high school game about $12.50. Today, they're paying in the hundreds, but $12.50. And I work maybe three games on the weekend, and I make $37.50. I thought, wow, this is like finding money. I love this. Never thought about being in the NFL. Never thought about going much further than maybe high school. And then I thought, no, college looks like I'd like to do that. And I did that. And then they came along, and the National Football League came along and said, we'd like you to work in the NFL. And I was assigned number 32. Didn't ask for it, but it's become a kind of a trademark number for me, number 32.
Jim, you know, I have to ask, how did they find you? Were they scouting kids on the field and they watched you at the same time? How did that happen?
I got lucky. It was 1960, I think. You were what, second grade probably, but I.
I'm not sure.
don't admit to anything.
Don't
admit to anything, Denise. I was working in the colleges in what they call now the Pac-12, which was called the Pacific Coast Conference at USC, UCLA, Stanford, Cal, Washington schools, Oregon schools. And I had happened to work a couple of intersectional games, which was nationally televised. And the NFL was now expanding to Dallas, was coming in the year 1960. The Minnesota Vikings were planned to come in 1961. Further, the AFL, the American Football League, was just starting in 1960 with Oakland and Kansas City and Houston and San Diego and places like that. And they wanted officials. They had none, and they wanted officials. So both leagues came to me and asked me if I would work in their league. And I thought, gee, that sounds like an interesting thing. But I took the NFL over the AFL because I had seen earlier other professional leagues start and fail because the NFL was so powerful and so good at what they're doing. I thought that's what I wanted to do. So I started in the AFL, in the NFL, and they didn't make me the position of referee, which I was for maybe 25 years in the NFL, but they started me in a position of field judge down the field so I could break in. It was a wonderful opportunity for me because I got to work with some wonderful leaders as referees and learned a lot from them.
So did you eventually just kind of move away from education into full-time? How did that look?
Yeah, I became a school superintendent. A little called Bellflower, California. It's down by Long Beach. It's a wonderful school district with two high schools and two junior high schools and 13 elementaries. And I was the assistant superintendent there for a while. And then they promoted me to school superintendent. And I was school superintendent. And I was speaking still part-time in the evenings or whenever I could to businesses and groups. They want to know so much about the NFL and how it works and how the athletes are the role models that many of them are. And so being on the field with coaches like Vince Lombardi and George Halas and quarterbacks like Bart Starr and Johnny Unitas and then Roger Staubach and all the way up the line, I was able to see firsthand about leadership and team building. And it evolved into our speaking so much that I thought, I think I'd like to do this full time. So I walked away from a school superintendency where I had tenure. I had tenure as a teacher. I had retirement pay. I had a secure job. I could be in that the rest of my life. They didn't, they could fire you as a superintendent, but you'll find someplace else. And I thought, I want to do this. I had a passion to do this coaching thing that I started at the age of 12. Now that I can get to coach audiences of several hundred or several thousand, and I've been doing that now so for about 40 years.
Well, you said something just now about role models then and now, and I read your column every week. I mean, on the Tiny Side of Sports, it's a great column. And I'll be very frank with our audience. I'm not a sports fan. In fact, what I know about football, you've taught me. I don't know much about it. In fact, you taught me what a touchback was. I had no clue what that was. But the thing is, I love to read your column because you're not just talking about sports. You're talking about all of the different things that I mentioned at the top of the show, all of the breakouts that are in your chapters in your book. And look, I mean, I don't watch cable TV. I won't have it in my house for a variety of reasons. Most of it's junk, and I don't want to pay for junk. But you can't avoid hearing about meltdowns in sports these days and some of these people that I think could be tremendous role models. I don't know what the heck they're thinking. Do you have any comments on what's going on?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, we have 1,700 NFL players. That's all the players each year that you have in the NFL. 1,700 out of the entire world. Only less than 2,000 people get to play professional football each year. And we get 4 or 5 of them, maybe 10, that attract this horrible attention of domestic violence and spousal abuse and guns and all this stuff that goes on. And if it happened to your plumber or your electrician or their gardener, nobody would care. Nobody would say, oh, well, so what, But if it happens to a running back or to a wide receiver or somebody who played in the Super Bowl, and that's big news. And that's the good news and the bad news. The bad news is that it happens and it shouldn't. The good news is that there are so many good players that are doing so many good things for people. You don't hear those kind of things about a Joe Montana or a Steve Young or a Roger Thomas.
Drew Brees does an enormous amount of work here.
He's done a great job, and an academic All-American from Purdue, and people like that. And yet, Will Smith, who played for the New Orleans Saints, has had this tragedy just recently. Every one of those players gets counseling as they come into the NFL about, now that you're there, we expect to hold you to a higher standard. And I've said to many of them many times, you have a special opportunity in the National Football League to do something for other people. And I've always felt that's why we're here on Earth, is to do something for other people, not for ourselves. If we get some glorification or gratification out of it, that's fine. But really, it's for what we can do with other people. In the NFL, they play on a team. Sure, they want to win the Super Bowl, but they're doing it for the enjoyment of the fans, and that's what they're doing it for, entertainment. And if they'll hold themselves to a higher standard, they'll be successful. But just a few of them, Denise, and not a high percentage, less than 2% of the people get into some kind of trouble. And we wish we could do something more with those people, like a Drew Brees, who are doing so many things for humanity, as he did for Katrina in the Louisiana area.
Right. And you know, I'm glad you put that into perspective, because it's so easy to read a headline, one of these screaming headlines in Daily Mail UK or wherever it is that you get your news, and just kind of, it's easy to taint an entire group of people. And I didn't realize that it was under 2,000 people. That's a lot. But in the scheme of things, it's really not a lot of people. So for just a few people who kind of act out and ruin their careers, I'm glad you put that into perspective for me, because these, they're not really tainting the entire brand, are they? Or are they? I don't know.
They're out there in front of everybody, for everything to see. In fact, one of the articles that I wrote about a player, he said, don't judge me for what goes on between the lines when I'm on the field. And I wrote and I said, that's the only way I can't judge you. I don't see you in your normal life. I don't live in your community. You live in another state, another community. I don't see you around your community. What I see on the field. And so on the field, those athletes have to show, I believe, the character, the sportsmanship, the dealing with other people that, for example, as we talk here on April the 15th, Jackie Robinson
right.
had all of those horrible things, the derogatory comments, and he held his head high. He held his head high to say, you know, I'm not going to fire back with that. You can't fight fire with fire, I believe.
Today is a big anniversary for him. In fact, it was in on this day in history. What was it, 45 years ago now? What is that story?
1947 was the first, in April 15th, 1947, was the first time that an African-American played in the major leagues, played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Brooklyn Dodgers, not Los Angeles Dodgers. And Jackie had I met Jackie Robinson. My dad was my role model. He was also a football official, and he refereed a game in the late 30s. You can do the math on the age later on, but in the late 30s, for Jackie Robinson, when he played for Pasadena Junior College, which was about 4 miles from where I lived, and I went to the game with my dad, and during the game, my dad came over. I was sitting on the bench. It was kind of a lack of security in those days. I was sitting on the Pasadena Junior College football bench, and he came over, and he said, "You watch this little color boy. He's really going to be something," and it was Jackie Robinson. Of course, in 1939, it was still, the use of colored was very common. My dad and I had the opportunity to coach football at a school, and he coached a guy named, that most people don't remember, Kenny Washington. Kenny Washington went to UCLA and then became one of the first black players to play in the National Football League. He was just a little bit ahead of Jackie Robinson, about 3 or 4 years. But here's Kenny going to UCLA and playing in the National Football League, one of the first of black players. And Jackie Robinson, a few years later, going to UCLA, left UCLA to play in the minor leagues, in the black minor leagues, as a matter of fact. And then Brian Fricke of the Dodgers put him into the Brooklyn Dodgers lineup April 15th, 1947. And today, every Major League Baseball player will have number 42 on a jersey. Every one of them. All the 30 teams. Yep.
That is nice. I mean, that's wonderful.
It's a tribute that is very singular. I don't know any football player, any basketball player, everyone has ever had a kind of impact that Robinson had in those days.
I'm going to have to look that up because I know you had mentioned that to me the other day, but I didn't understand. We were talking about a lot of other things like we always do, but I didn't realize what a singular honor that is. So I'm going to have to go search for that when we're off the call.
And since you had, Kate, we might want to turn that television on. And if you see a baseball game, huh? if you see a Major League Baseball game being played today, and it will be, and you look at the players, they all have number 42. Only day of the year that ever happens.
That is excellent.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Listen, we've had a lot of conversations over time because we're very good friends, and you share a lot with me about your life, and you've got some fabulous friends. This has nothing at all to do with your book, but I have to bring it up because, I mean, you have shared with me that some of the people that you know and you have just had a lot of interactions with, I mean, Jim Nabors, we were talking about him the other day. He's a friend of yours. A very good friend of yours is Coach Don Shula. I mean, you've got a lot of really interesting friends, and I include myself in that group, by the way.
Well, you're very kind. I've had a lot of good things happen that I believe if you work at something and maybe you don't achieve that, something else will happen. For example, and I became a teacher, and then, as I mentioned, a high school principal. And I passed the principal's exam and was assigned to a school called Fairfax High School, which is in West Hollywood, in the 60s. And when I went to the school, it was a very promising school, good school. Our kids were going to the Ivy Leagues and the Seven Sisters and the major colleges all over the country. And we had a celebrity assembly, for example, that if you bought our student body card, you get to see this celebrity special assembly. And I said, well, who do we have? And they didn't have, who are the alumni of this school? And they said, well, Herb Alpert is one of them. And this is in the middle 60s. So I called Herb Alpert's office and met Herb Alpert and had him come to the school for 2,000 kids that are there.
Brazil
and put 66, on a performance.
Right? Herb Alpert.
Exactly. Herb Alpert and Tijuana Brass.
Tijuana Brass. Okay, I'm thinking Sergio Mendez.
No. You're leading right? in. You're ahead of me in the story, but you're doing
sorry.
Well. No, Herb came and talked, and he likes to talk to people in the audience. The Tijuana Brass played for the kids. And the next year, I said, well, who do we get? And they got a guy named Sergio Mendez of Brazil 66 came the next year. And the following year, we had Alan Sherman. The following year, we had the Fifth Dimension. The following year, we had Bill Cosby. And the following year, it was just on and on and on. I get a chance to meet all those people. Herb Alpert then finally asked me to come work for him, and I worked for Herb Alpert Foundation for 2 years. And along that line, I'm now a refereeing football game in the Coliseum and singing the national anthem was a fellow named Jim Nabors. And Jim Nabors was now had the Nabors show in the late 60s, I called him Gomer. I said, listen, you're at CBS Studios. We're at Fairfax High School at Melrose and Fairfax. We're 3 blocks from you. Why don't you come up to the school? He said, why don't you come down and see a show? So I went down and saw the show several times. Jim Nabors walked on the campus one day and just walked around and talked to kids in the middle of all his Jim Nabors hours that he had. And these things just happen. They just come along like that. And to know Herb Alpert and Jim Nabors and a new Bill Cosby when he was a wonderful man. He did a great deal with the kids. And I'm sorry to hear all the stuff that he's gone through. I can't comment on that because I don't know anything about it. It's just me and those people over the years. And I think the National Football League, very honestly, Denise, gave me a line in terms of knowing that. In fact, I was working a game in the Los Angeles Coliseum when the Los Angeles Rams were playing there. I was walking onto the field, and this guy came up behind me and pulled a flag out of my pocket, and it was Bill Cosby. And I said, hello,
Did
Billy.
Did you turn around and yell at him?
Yeah, I said, turn around and said hello, and he said, he was with another guy. He said, you know Anthony Quinn, don't you? I don't know Anthony Quinn.
Oh, my
Quinn.
Goodness.
How do you fall in? I walked into Herb Alpert's office one day, and he says, and Bert Bacharach was here. He says, Jim, you know Bert, don't you? I don't know these people. I'm just a little kid from San Gabriel, California. But those things came along as a result of just doing one thing for somebody else. And the more things I get to do for other people, I like doing this for Denise Griffiths and things like that. Other great things happen.
It does, and I have found that too. And it took me the longest kind of time, I have to admit, because I'm a loner. I will always be a loner. I'm a high functioning introvert and workaholic, and I like to be alone. I mean, that's just the most of it. But I have found just what you're saying, that you know, when I get to interact with other people like you and just so many people that I've interviewed, one thing leads to another without fail, and they're all good things. And I look forward to them because, I mean, I get to meet and speak with the greatest people who know great people and who are going to share that. I mean, you do have to kind of put yourself out there every now and then and say, hey, you know, here I am, talk to me. And that's hard for me, I'll be honest.
It always has served me when I see people giving up that that can deal with things going on in their life. I always said, you got to play the hand you're dealt. And no matter what comes along your way, you've got to deal with it. So you just don't ever stop. Don't ever quit. I always think, you know, the number of years I've been at this now with teaching and coaching and refereeing and still working for the National Football League at my age, I think, you know, retirement is the worst 10-letter word I can think of because I don't want to retire. I like doing things. I like doing it. It helps me as a person, but if I can do something for somebody else, that's the idea. For me, that's what life is all about.
I agree with you. I will never retire. In fact, I will probably pass away in my sleep while I'm plotting world domination. I'm never giving up. I'm so glad you brought up the NFL because I think probably a lot of our audience doesn't know or maybe is not aware that you're actually still working for the NFL in a capacity. You're still the ref in the box, right?
I am. That's a good one. I had not heard that expression. I'm glad you came up with the ref in the box. My job as a mentor, particularly to there are seven officials on the field. One of them has a white hat. He's the referee. He's the leader. He's the crew chief. And my job as a mentor is to help him, not just calling fouls on the field, but leadership. Because you look at the referee in the white hat, because he's the one you see who comes over and makes the announcements and gives the signals and enforces the penalties and talks to the coaches and talks to the captains and people like that. He's the leader. And my job, because I've been in leadership all my life, is to help him become a better leader. And I say him now, but we also, as you well know, we do have a woman official in the National Football League for the first time last year. Sarah Thomas was a line judge. She was born in Pascagoula, Mississippi, as a matter of fact. And if you've ever been to Pascagoula, Mississippi, you know it is just about the furthest south of this country you can almost go. She's a wonderful lady, and she's done a good job the first year. Always the first year, we call her a rookie, as we call all officials, the first year a rookie. They always have their trials and tribulations as a rookie. Anytime you start a new job, you have things that you thought you wished at the end of the year you could have done a little better, and Sarah's in that. In that vein, but she's done a good job. But my job as a mentor, sit in the press box, I meet with the crew ahead of time. And people probably don't realize that the crew of seven officials who work together, same seven people all week all year long, meet on Saturday in the afternoon and go over films, go over rules, go over discussion of a thing we call the word mechanics. That's the positioning of the officials on the field. And most people don't realize, first, that there are seven, second, where they are stationed around the field, so that we have them, we have the play boxed in all the time. And if we don't get the play boxed in and it gets away from us, we can be susceptible to missing a catch of a ball or a tackle or a penalty or something like that, a foul that would happen. And my job as a referee in the box, the mentor, is to help the referee see the whole field and understand how the rest of his crew is working. And it's important that that he shows the leadership on the field, because that's what you see sitting, not you, but other people who watch television, sitting in their living room looking at that screen. That's the guy they're focusing on, and that's the one that I've been working on now for the last 3 years. And about 3 years ago, the officiating department asked me to come back and work as a mentor and as a, they call it, a trainer. And that's exactly what I do. But it's more of a mentor job. It's not so much training them to be calling fouls or being sure you see the right foul. They learn that, and they know that. We have some wonderful officials, and they're good people. They're people who do the things in life, and they all have other jobs that you'd be proud to have them as a neighbor, because they're just like kind of a person.
And you travel quite a bit doing this, don't you? I mean, it's not just games in California. You're all over the country.
I have been, and that's fine in different stadiums. Working in the NFL on the field, I was on the field for 31 years, so I've seen every stadium. But now, in the last few years, that I was not on the field, and they built some new stadiums, I get a chance to see some of the new stadiums and travel, and that's fine. Travel is not the best thing in the world right now, but that's what we do. That's the name of the game. You've got to get on an airplane and go someplace, or because I'm living in California, a couple of teams are close enough that I can drive. But most of the time, you get on the airplane, you're there Saturday with the officials, and work with them in their meeting, and then on Sunday you're with them before the game, during the game, after the game, and then during the week I talk with the referee and about this and that or the other thing, things that come up that were maybe new to him that I've seen before.
Well, while we're on this subject, Dave Sanderson, who is also a friend of mine, in fact, for our audience, Dave Sanderson was the last passenger off of the plane that landed in the Hudson, the Miracle on the Hudson. And he is a huge fan of Jim, so he really wanted to ask a question. His question to you, Jim, is, with all the scrutiny on NFL referees and officials this past year, how have you seen their role change since you retired? But are you really retired? I guess that's two questions. One from him, one from me.
Probably after I left the field, the game has changed considerably in lots of ways. First of all, we changed some rules, and we're changing them all the time to provide safety measures for the players. We're always involved in safety, and the officials on the field are that's one of their biggest jobs is to be sure the players are playing within the rules. If they play within the rules, then the safety factors will come into being. The other thing is it changes the size and strength and speed of the players. It's incredible to see some of these people who are 300 pounds that are maybe 6'8". I can't imagine having a son who's 6'8", 300 pounds, eating at my dinner table four or five steaks at a time.
Wow.
And they're fast and they're strong, and the game has changed considerably that way. The game of people that played in the past. For example, one of the people I've known off the field and who was very prominent in the NFL for years is a guy named Dick Butkus. Dick Butkus played for the Chicago Bears, went to the University of Illinois, played for the Chicago Bears, was an All-Pro, Hall of Famer. But where would you play him today? Because the size and speed of Dick Butkus in those days was fine. Today, it's not up to the standard. Now, if he played in today's environment, he would have grown into that standard, I'm sure. But the standards have changed so much, and the style of play has changed so much. For a long time, football is a game of running the football. you sweep this side, block this way, do that sort of thing. And that's changed now. We have a lot of passing and a lot of what we call wide receivers, the ends that are very, very fast. And so because the ends are fast now, they've changed the defense. The defense used to be big, strong players in the defensive secondary, the safeties and the wide and the cornerbacks. They have to now be as fast as the wide receivers. And so we've changed the style of play, and we've changed the kind of people that are being in the draft, which is coming up in 2 weeks, and they'll be drafting players that will match what their talents on the team are with the teams that they're going to play. So the style has changed a lot.
It's become very scientific, hasn't it?
Well, I can remember when we first had video cameras and videotapes, they would film it from the press box, and then they would send the tape from the press box and the image on a piece of paper down the wire to the field. And now it is so with all the computer technology and everything. A Peyton Manning who's just retired, Peyton can go over to the sidelines and on his tablet, look at the play that's happened. And look, it's so scientific now, and all the intricacies of films. And going back to the officials, by the way, people say, well, they're only part-time. They only work on Sunday afternoon. That's not so. All during the week, these officials have their own tablet, and they're looking at the game that they have. They look at the game that they're going to have. They look at other plays that happen at other. They get the game. The highlight plays of all of the teams can be right there in their home. And during the week, whatever job they may have other than that, they're looking at film almost every day. Every day they look at some kind of a tape or video, or talking to the league office or talking to other officials. It becomes a full-time job. I don't know that as a high school principal, I could have done all that on the requirement of the NFL now and be a high school principal, which was a 10 to 12 hour job every day.
You know, I really don't. I'm going to say it again. I'm probably going to make enemies here. I really don't watch games, but on the rare occasions that I do, and I did watch a Super Bowl with Drew Brees, of course. But I have always been astonished that one or two officials, you and whoever's on the field, how in the world can y'all cover that massive field? I've never understood that. I mean, how can you see everything? I mean, is your head on a swivel? How does that work?
Goes back to the question you asked earlier, Dave Anderson said about what's the change. When I first started in the NFL, well, I worked in colleges, we worked with four officials. Same 22 guys on the field, but four officials covered it. I went into the NFL, we had five officials. Well, that's a good idea. Then in the middle of the 60s, we got a sixth official. In the middle of the 70s, we got a seventh official. So now we have seven officials. And next year, or if it doesn't happen next year, it's going to happen the year after, we're going to have eight officials. I mean, the game has changed so dramatically that four officials couldn't possibly cover the game that we had. So the game has changed so dramatically that we've gone from four officials in high school and colleges in the 50s to five, to six, to seven, and now pretty soon to eight officials because the game is so intricate now. So that's how we cover it, and because we need to keep it what we call boxed in so we don't let it get away from us.
And that leads me to my next question, because you've been doing this for quite a while. When you first started out, how did you communicate with the other officials on the team? I mean, I can't picture you guys having headsets or earbuds or any of that. How did you smoke signals? How did you do it?
That's a great question. It's a perfect question, because it leads into what is going on today and how it's changed. In the days of four and five officials, it was all nonverbal. Nonverbal communication, and since you work with these people, the other officials, often you know who covers what down what sideline or down the middle of the field, and then your responsibilities, and you sort of weave in together, and you do it nonverbally, or you talk to each other. In today's environment, it's happened now, but the last 3 to 4 years, all officials wear a microphone and a headset. And they have what they call O2O, official to official. And you can talk to each other on the field. So if there's a play 25 yards down the field, Maybe it's a defensive pass interference, for example, long play down the field. The back judge who's down there needs to tell the referee about the foul. He said, I have pass interference on number 25. The officials don't have to run all the way down to meet with each other. He can tell them over this closed circuit communication what the officials, so the referee can then step out, away from the players and say, pass interference, defense, number 25. And that communication is brand new. This game has changed so much that communication has to keep up with it. And as you know now, also, the quarterback has in his helmet, has a receiver. He can't talk back to the coach. Shouldn't anyway. But the coach can talk to him and tell him what plays he wants run ahead of time. Before it was all, you'd send in a player and he'd go into the huddle and say, okay, we're going to run this, so the coach wants to run this play. Not anymore. The coach says, let's go Brown X right on two, and whatever that means, whatever player. And it's very intricate. In fact, you will see players like a Drew Brees of the Saints, and since you mentioned him, he will look at his arm, and on his arm, he has a list of all the plays. And when the coach calls the play in, he just gives them the number or whatever he may give them. He can look at his play at his arm, and then he can say to the lineman, here's the play, here's your blocking assignment, because the blocking assignments are so integral and intricate now that you've got to have it's a sophisticated system way in advance of what it was a number of years ago. So the game, and it's going to keep changing that way.
It doesn't sound like much of a game anymore. I mean, it doesn't sound like you're relying on your players to get the job done and that they're out there having fun. It sounds like they're just kind of being ordered. It just sounds like, I don't know this, but it sounds, if I had somebody in my ear telling me what to do all the time, you know me, Jim. You know how that would work.
Denise, that's not going to work with you. No,
it won't.
But this is a team game, Denise, with 11 players doing 11 different jobs for a single purpose. but it almost becomes a video game, because that's what you're seeing now. Is all this stuff is so high tech, and I will quote Vince Lombardi, because he was such an icon in this whole thing and the development of the National Football League. And Lombardi has always said, you got to knock somebody down. This game is about blocking and tackling. And it is still about blocking and tackling. That's what it's all about. Now, we try to help players understand how blocking and tackling applies to the 21st century, so that we are now in 2016, and we teach them how to tackle and block. They didn't learn this when I was playing football and we grew up. We all learned certain techniques. They've gotten away from that now to what we call the last few years, what I call Terminator football. You just blast into somebody. That's not the name of the game. The name of the game is just tackling somebody and running with the football and throwing the football and blocking people. And that's what it's all about. And the blocking rules have changed because these players are so big and strong now. It used to, I know it makes sense perhaps to do these, but to your listeners, you'd put your arms against your body. You had to block with your shoulders. Now you can, offensive players can push the defensive players. They can actually use their hands to push away from them, because you can't block some of these big, strong guys like that anymore. You can't block J.J. Watts by putting your arms against your body. You've got to use your hands, and still, he's so big and strong that it's hard to block somebody like that. So it's still a blocking and tackling game, but the techniques of the technology has changed so much that it's gotten a lot to that with that.
Well, and that leads me to one of the chapters in your book, which is teamwork. So from what you're saying, the game has changed so dramatically, and there's so many people involved and so much technology involved, that these guys really have to study, and they really have to be in touch with their team members, don't they? I mean, they have to almost be able to anticipate what's going on.
And that's why I mentioned about the officials doing something all the time. The players are working all week long. They have one day off a week. Usually it's Tuesday. But they're working every day, not so much on the field now, but in the classroom type of thing of what we're doing, how we're going to attack or defeat the opponent of next Sunday's game. So there's a lot of that, and all the players are now working with their iPads and their tablets and things like that. They all carry them. They all do it. That's what it's all about now. They're different.
I did know that. I did know that, actually, because one of my clients works a lot with NFL quarterbacks, and his name is Todd Durkin. In fact, he was just on NBC night before last night.
I saw him.
On this new program, Strong. Yeah. And, I mean, these quarterbacks go into his facility in San Diego, and he works them about half to death. So, and I get to see the videos. I'm very privileged to see videos that other people don't. But I'm telling these guys, it's impressive how whatever they're asked to do, however they're asked to stretch themselves, they do it, and they don't complain. They just do it.
No.
They get the job done.
They do it because that's the name of the game now, and you, in order to play it at this level, at this day and age, you've got to stay up with all that sort of thing. And I try to explain some of that in some of the writings that I do, and that's been sort of a thing that's come along in the last number of years, is to try to explain why people do certain things, and articles that I wrote in the Tunney Side of Sports, and those kind of things, try to help people understand that how much the game has changed.
Well, not only that, but the people have changed, the audience has changed, the players have changed, just the technology that is brought to bear has changed. And that kind of leads me back to your column, because, I mean, you talk about just about anything to have to do with sports and values and all the different judgment, integrity, all the things that are going on. But I wanted to mention, you've got a big anniversary of sorts coming on with that column, don't you?
I do. It's just it's been a labor of love for me. It's I write for the local paper, is the one who asked me if I'd write a newspaper column for them, and I do that every week. And I can't believe it. I'm writing now number 590. I've written 590 columns of 500 words each over the years that talk about competence and courage and integrity and judgment and personal growth and teamwork, team values, and things like that. And people say, I get a question probably once a week. Oh, you come out every week with these. You haven't missed a week in 11 years. Where do you get your ideas? And I always think of Johnny Carson. He does a monologue for 15 minutes every night. He did it for 30 years. And somebody said, where do you get your ideas for these monologues? He said, as long as Ronald Reagan is president, I'll always have ideas.
Oh, I like Ronald Reagan.
I do too. And Johnny did too. And he had a regularized program many times. But as long as there are sports, I always get ideas. There's always something that people might look at it. For example, today being April 15th and the anniversary of Jackie Robinson. And because my history has some relationship with Jackie Robinson, I thought, I can write about that, but the article that comes out on Monday, called On Sunny Side of Sports, that comes out every Monday in the paper as well.
I've already
as
read it, by the way. Don't want to make anybody jealous, but I've already read it.
Good for you.
I had access to it.
What it did is to combine two people that I know, Jackie Robinson and a guy named Burl Toler. Burl is the first African-American official on the field. We had never had a black official. And Burl and I worked together for 11 years. Every Saturday and Sunday, we were together with Burl. So we got to be family more than anything else. I knew his kids, Marty and Susan and Valerie and all those kids. I watched them all grow up. And Burl was the first black official. And in the days that he started, he got some of the same derogatory remarks that Jackie Robinson did. And often when a coach would be yelling or screaming at him about a call or something, I'd just go over and stand alongside him and let him take – he took it, and it was character and dignity. He never fought back that way, but oftentimes I'd step up and say, okay, coach, that's enough, and let it go from there. But Burl held his head high all the time, as did Jackie Robinson. So it was a great combination that I wrote about for the thing on number 42, which is Jackie Robinson, number 37, who was Burl Toler. So these things just happen, and I'm looking at it. How can I help people understand that in today's environment, you're going to get those kind of derogatory remarks, and how you treat them with your character, with your strength and your courage is very important, because it happens every day. It happens to my granddaughters who are talking about the bullying that goes on at school, and how you deal with that. So you write about something that happened on the field and related to the bullying that kids are getting today, and electronically, cyberbullying, as they call it, and how you deal with that.
Well, when you have a lot of people, you're going to have problems. That's just going to happen. But you're right. It's how you stand up and present yourself is what makes the difference in the world. And that leads me to another question, because you're saying that, you know, coaches sometimes can holler at you guys, which I kind of figured they did. Do you have any stories about, you know, any notable incidents with a coach that made you just go, what? What did you just say to me? Or would you rather not share?
Do we have another hour?
Yeah, we could do another show.
I got a lot of stories. One that that you mentioned earlier, Don Shula. And Don and I have become good friends. I've always contended, Denise, that you are best friends with somebody. Either you have a love affair or a confrontation. Well, I never had a love affair with Don Shula, but we had a lot of confrontations. And I had a call years ago that he didn't like, and he was coaching the Baltimore Colts, and he yelled and screamed at me, and every time he'd see me, he'd bring that up over the years. And some 15 or 16 years later, he was now coaching the Miami Dolphins, and they're playing the Washington Redskins. And there was another call in the game that I didn't make, but one of my teammates did, the crew, where I was the crew chief. And he was yelling and screaming at this guy. And this is this guy's first year. And he said, the official said to me, you want me to go over and explain the call to Coach Shula? And I said, no. You don't know him like I do. Let me go over. So I went over, and Shula was out on the field, and he was screaming. The veins in his neck were popping. I could see the redness in his face and everything. And finally, I just listened, and he said, you've been screwing me for 15 years. And I looked at him and said, no, Don, it's 16 now. And he laughed, and I laughed, and it was over. And it was just dealing, you know, not getting upset with the fact that he was swearing at you, or saying the fact that your mother and father were never really married, and all the words that they would possibly use. And if you can understand and rise above that, and understand the heat of the situation, and I don't know where that line came from, 16, not 15, but it was there, and it came out, and it took the pressure off right away. And I think when we're dealing with other people, when they're upset with us, and that's where this road rage comes in. You don't want to fight back on road rage. It's a battle. You have to rise above it. And sometimes there are good things that are going to happen to you in life that are not fair. It's not right. It shouldn't happen to you. You didn't deserve that. But that's what life is all about. It's going to happen from time to time. So how you deal with that, and that's one of the things I think in sports. Sports can teach you that if you'll pay attention to it. If you'll listen to your coaches, you listen to some of your other teammates that will say, you know, let it go, just move on from there. And that move on is a pretty good expression for lots of people.
I agree. It took me a long time to learn that, but I finally did learn it. We have one more question. I think I did, anyway. We have one more question. Stephen Mark wants to know, what is the funniest thing you've ever heard on the field?
Well, that line with Shula was kind of funny. He laughed at my idea. There are a lot of things that happen that are funny on the field at the time, but they don't translate into funny stories. This is a business, and I always thought that it's very important for an official on the field not to be laughing at things, because if you're laughing at something that happened to one player, to the other player, it may be offensive, and you don't want to do that. It's like you'll see an official pick a player up off the ground, and I always said to them, don't pick up players, because you're not going to pick up everybody. So if you pick up this team, you got to do that one. And if you pick up somebody that maybe had a dislocated rib or something because of a hit that he took, you may be doing injury. Because you could pick up the quarterback who's maybe 200 pounds, but you're not going to pick up a lineman who's 150 pounds. So you can't win that one. And there's things that happen that are funny that people will laugh at, and players are laughing a lot, and they should. If you watch many of these teams, I think there's a lot of laughter and joking going on the sideline, but they're on the same team, and you know officials don't have a home field. The only team they have is the seven of them, and they shouldn't be laughing together on the field because somebody's going to interpret that as something against another team. This idea of impartiality is so important. Walks a very thin line, and you need to do that as an official so that you're not offending one team if you're laughing at another.
I know one of the books that you've written is called Impartial Judgment, and I'm guessing that's where that title came from.
I wanted to call that book "Cause I Don't Care Who Wins," and it really came from John Madden, who won Super Bowl XI as I refereed, and I saw him the next year, and he had this great big ring on that the Super Bowl players and coaches get. And I said, John, you and I worked Super Bowl XI. You were the coach. I was the referee. We were on the same field for 3 hours. You got a beautiful ring. The league gave me this crummy Timex watch. What's the difference? He says, because you don't care who wins. And I don't, as a referee. I don't care who wins. It doesn't make any difference to me whether it's the New Orleans Saints or the Atlanta Falcons. It makes no difference at all. I'm there because the game is to be run fairly and by the rules, and that's my job. But the publisher didn't like the title I Don't Care Who Wins, so that's why he said Impartial Judgment, and I think that's what official has, impartiality.
That makes sense. We have another question, but we're not going to have time. So, Tim, what is your favorite part of, and I know this is a tough question, what is your favorite part about working for the NFL all these years? I mean, do you have any kind of sections, or is it all just great?
I think it was a tough job, and for me, probably the toughest part was being gone every Saturday and Sunday for 31 years, traveling and not being with the children that I raised on a Sunday afternoon, playing in the park with them. And being away from the family is always tough, but to be associated with and my kids have said it too many times, Dad, you get to associate with some of the people who are world famous, the Don Shula's, the Vince Lombardi's, the Bart Starrs, all the quarterbacks, all the coaches that for a number of years that everybody knew, and became friends with after on the field, and that was always an important part to me. And so when my son Mark got married about 27 years ago, he asked me to be the best man. I said, "You got lots of friends in college and high school, be your best." He said, "Dad, you were always there for me." And I think that's probably the nicest thing that a son can ever say to a father is to say, "Would you be the best man at my wedding?" And he's still married to lovely Sue, and I was honored to be the best man. That helped. That helped a lot because I felt somewhat uneasy about being gone so much. And yet all the family loved it. It was enjoyable for me as well as for them.
Well, you know, honestly, for parenting, I think it's the quality of the parenting rather than the time. I really do. I mean, you can spend all day, all night with kids and not really pay attention to them, but it sounds to me, and of course I follow you on, you know, your personal Facebook page and watch the interaction that your kids have with you, and it seems to me that they very much appreciated the quality parenting rather than the time that you did or did not spend with them. It sounds that when you were with them, that you were all in.
That's a wonderful statement, quality versus quantity. And when I am with them, it's them. That's what it's all about. And I talk to my kids. I've talked to probably every one of them at least once a week. And they're all over the country in different places, Phoenix, Chicago, Seattle, Los Angeles, None of them live in the community where I do, which is unfortunate because I get to see my grandkids often enough. But that's it's a quality time that I get to spend with them that makes a difference. So no question about that. I enjoy that part.
You have had a fabulous life. I mean, when we get on the phone and you start telling me some of these stories, it just pop up out of nowhere because we get into these long-ranging conversations. And every single time I hang up the phone with you, I walk around just laughing because, I mean, you tell the greatest stories. And they're all about
Thank
your
you.
Life and the experiences that you've had. And I'm going to nag at you on radio. I keep begging you to write a book about all these, not just the sports, but all the different experiences
sure.
you have. So that's nag number one. I'll follow it up with nag number two in an email. Just
I
so
need
know.
To do that. No, I agree with you,
you
nag number one.
Yeah, I would love to. I mean, just an oral history. Put it on audio. Or
sure.
I mean, you have got truly fascinating and very, very entertaining stories.
Ken Blanchard has been a good friend of mine for 35 years now. He said to me recently, he said, is the best part of your life behind you or ahead of you? I say, I got to say it's ahead of me. I don't want to live in the past. I want to live in today and tomorrow and the future. So I'm looking forward to doing some more good things, as many things I can every day.
Well, I am thankful that you are such a good friend of mine, and I thoroughly enjoy chatting with you and interacting with you in any way we can. And thank you so much for being with me here today. It's been wonderful.
You're
chatting
a wonderful,
with you.
You're a wonderful friend and a great host. You're a great, great interviewer. Great job today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, listen, I know our audience enjoyed the takeaways and the examples as much as I did. And if everybody who's listening, the show will be available for download in about an hour. And you will also be able to find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Jim Tunney. And I will see you next week. Jim, thank you.
Goodbye.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.